the original date. I can't tell you that today. We have to get the teams moving to see how fast they are. I'll tell you what, in 6 weeks, I'll give you our delivery date, and it isn't going to be one you'll like. But, I said quickly before he could interrupt, I'll give you a list of the things that are getting in your team's way, that are stopping them from meeting that July date you promised Wall Street, a list of impediments, and your job will be to remove them as fast as possible. He laughed. Impediments? No problem, Jeff. I used to work at Toyota. I laughed and said, this looks like a good project already. I knew that he'd embraced Taichi Ono's taxonomy of waste and understood how things worked, that getting rid of waste was the key to accelerating teams. And so, after three sprints of measuring velocity, the teams had accelerated from 20 to 60 points per sprint, and I knew when the teams would likely deliver. Given the velocity of the teams, and we were now at the beginning of March, it would take them another 19 two-week sprints, December 1st. Management wasn't happy. Not good enough. It was July 7 or nothing. Everything was riding on it. Then I handed them a memo with a list of 12 impediments on it. They ranged from not empowering people to make decisions, to onerous technical requirements, from people not showing up for meetings, to simple things, such as not having everybody on a team work in the same room. There were process, personality, and procedure problems, the kind of things that are endemic to any corporation. These kinds of impediments can seem insurmountable. How often have you looked around at your own workplace and thought, we do it this way, we've always done it this way, and everyone knows it's dumb. But for some reason, people see corporate cultural change as impossible. I used to agree with them, especially when it came to big companies with an ossified culture and policies. Medco proved me wrong, and I'll never go back to my old way of thinking. That senior vice president from Toyota sent out our memo to his entire staff on a Monday. Each impediment had a manager's name next to it, and each one of the impediments was gone by Thursday. Maybe to be motivated to change, people sometimes need a gun to their head, but it showed what can be done if the will is there, or if you have a guy from Toyota in charge. Nothing is written in stone. Question everything. By the end of the next sprint, the team's velocity had gone up 50%. The new date for delivery was September 1st. Still 3 months late, even though they'd accelerated from 20 points to 90 points per sprint, over 400%, and still not good enough. So Brent and I gathered everyone together, from engineering to marketing to business analysts to compliance folks to management. And they were afraid. They were afraid for their jobs and careers if they couldn't pull this off. So I asked them three questions. One, is there anything we can do differently to speed things up? Well, said the head of engineering, during the middle of the last sprint, the IT security guys shut off a port to the internet, so our teams in India and Brazil couldn't get anything done. Well, we should fix that, shouldn't we? I said in disbelief. The head of engineering looked at the head of IT, who was sitting farther down the table. They thought that might knock another month off the time it would take to deliver the product. 2 months to go. Two, can we offload some backlog items? Is there stuff we can get other teams to do? No one had any good ideas. Three, can we not do some things? Can we reduce the scope of the project by any amount? Originally, they told me no way, that they'd already cut to the bone on requirements. Okay, I said, but let's just spend the afternoon whittling away at it. Every single task has to fight for its life. It took a few hours, but we got another month off delivery. That's when I said, okay, we're still a month off the date. If we can't figure out something else, we're going to need to tell management we can't do it. No, everyone replied, we'll all get fired. Let's take a look at those three questions again. I propose we meet with the management team. It was not just our problem, it was their problem as well, and they could help. It was a short meeting. Management looked at the situation and said, well, we have to deliver on July 7th. Maybe we could just roll it out to one factory first, one center, or only a couple. Would that work? There was some hemming and hawing and rearranging of a few things, but they eventually figured out that they could reduce the features needed and meet the July 2007 date the president had promised Wall Street. At the end of that meeting, the senior vice president simply said, let's declare victory. Call us if you run into any problems. It was amazing to watch the stock price of Medco that summer. When we started building the infrastructure, the stock started going up. And when we delivered, it continued to rise. How much? Well, many billions of dollars worth, from a price of 25 to over 50 within the year. Wall Street had decided the company would continue to grow, would attract new customers, and would maintain its leadership in the field. In retrospect, I should have asked for a percentage of market cap increase rather than a simple fee. A few years later, Medco used Scrum to build what they called Medco 2.0. They restructured every part of the company from the steel out. New factories, new robots, new processes, more automation. Mark Landy, who by then was the chief technical officer of the company, says that without the therapeutic resource center experience, they couldn't have done it. They wouldn't have allowed us to do it enterprise-wide. But we had the confidence of the entire organization, development, operations, finance, clinical. We were able to make a new culture. And that, he says, is the most important part of Scrum. It changes the culture people work in, which can be scary for some. Indeed, the company had to get rid of employees who couldn't make the switch, he says. Not because they were incompetent, but because they were hoarding information and knowledge for their own benefit, to ensure their own indispensability rather than helping the team and the company. Changing that culture, though, is what allows true excellence to emerge. The takeaway. The map is not the terrain. Don't fall in love with your plan. It's almost certainly wrong. Only plan what you need to. Don't try to project everything out years in advance. Just plan enough to keep your teams busy. What kind of dog is it? Don't estimate in absolute terms like hours. It's been proven that humans are terrible at that. Size things relatively, by which breed of dog the program is, or t-shirt sizes, or, more commonly, the Fibonacci sequence. Ask the oracle. Use a blind technique like the Delphi method to avoid anchoring biases such as the halo effect or bandwagon effect or just plain stupid groupthink. Plan with poker. Use planning poker to quickly estimate work that needs to be done. Work is a story. Think first about who will be getting value from something, then about what it is, and then why they need it. Humans think in narratives, so give them one. As an X, I want Y, so that Z. Know your velocity. Every team should know exactly how much work they can get done in each sprint. And they should know how much they can improve that velocity by working smarter and removing barriers that are slowing them down. Velocity times time equals delivery. Once you know how fast you're going, you'll know how soon you'll get there. Set audacious goals. With Scrum, it is not that hard to double production or cut delivery time in half. If you do it in the right way, your revenue and stock price should double as well. Chapter 7. Happiness. People want to be happy. Not happy in a complacent, sheep-like way, but in a way that is more active. Thomas Jefferson, among many others, extolled the kind of happiness that comes from a pursuit. Pursuits do seem to be what make us happy. Scrum, done in the right way, will make workers, customers, managers, and stockholders happy, usually in that order. Real happiness doesn't come easy. I met a mountain climber once who sold me a photo of the top of the Himalayas as the sun was setting. He took it shortly after he reached the peak of Mount Everest, solo, too late in the day. It seemed impossible to get back to base camp before dark. If he didn't, he was certain to freeze to death. The poignancy of the photo reflected his feelings as he wrote what he thought might be his last note, that he was happy to have achieved the peak despite the fact that whoever may read the note might find him dead. If you speak to mountain climbers about an expedition, they won't spend much time talking about the experience of summiting a peak. Instead, they'll talk about the frigid temperatures, the painful blisters, the bad food, the crappy conditions, and the bulky equipment. And they'll tell you that after the elation of reaching the summit, there's usually a letdown, unless the near-death experience continues. They've done it. Their struggle has achieved something. But if you ask them when they were happiest, they'll tell you it was in those moments of trial, of pushing their bodies, minds, and spirits to the limit. That's when they were happiest, when they experienced true joy. And that's what they want to experience again. On the face of it, no sane person would voluntarily put herself through that kind of thing twice. Yet climbers seem unable to stop themselves, challenging peak after peak, seeking joy in pursuit of the next summit. What's fascinating is that most cultures are not set up to reward and encourage that specific type of happiness. Professor Tal Ben-Shahar taught the most popular course at Harvard University, positive psychology. In his book Happier, Ben-Shahar writes, "We are not rewarded for enjoying the journey itself, but for the successful completion of a journey. Society rewards results, not processes, arrivals, not journeys. But our day-to-day life is mostly made up of journeys. We don't summit peaks every day, or make the big score, or get a big bonus. Most of our days are taken up with striving toward our goals, whatever they may be. In a company, the goal may be to deliver the next great product, or make people's lives a little better with it, or solve some problem that vexes the world. But if we get rewarded only for results, not processes, we're going to be pretty miserable." When I first left academia for the business world in the early 1980s, I was put in charge of dozens of computer programmers who were miserable. Their projects were always late and over budget, and that's when the projects worked at all. Their mood became so negative that the energy in the room brought everyone down. The process they used was so broken, it was impossible to succeed. I've spent the last 30 years addressing that type of problem. The importance of happiness really hit me when I was setting up my first Scrum team. I realized that I had to address the team's emotional state as well as its mental state. For a West Point-trained fighter pilot, this was something of an adjustment. I was used to things being cut and dried. Being clinical and scientific, it took me some time to figure out that to empower people, to change their lives for the better, I had to change myself. Over the course of that first Scrum effort, I realized that true greatness is deeply rooted in joy, and that to be joyful is to take the first step towards success. If all that sounds a little new agey, or as if I'm about to tell you to sit around a campfire and sing Kumbaya, you should know that in my early days of advising startups, the venture capitalists I worked with thought I was the flower child from San Francisco. Empowering people would never work in their worldview. Of course, these days, I'm a senior consultant to venture firms, and I'm often treated like an oracle. When people have a hard problem, they ask the oracle for the solution. They don't necessarily expect the answer to make sense. They just try it. And to their surprise, it almost always works. That's because happiness is crucial to your business and is actually a better forward predictor of revenue than most of the metrics your CFO provides. In this chapter, I'm going to lay out just how important happiness is to your bottom line and how to capture, measure, and apply it. This is happiness with rigor. I may have become a better person through developing Scrum, which makes my family and me happier. But as a businessman and a scientist, I like hard data. Happiness is success. The research is startlingly clear. Happy people simply do better. At home, at work, in life. They make more money, they have better jobs, they graduate from college, and they live longer. It's quite remarkable. Almost universally, they're just better at what they do. Happy people sell more stuff, make more money, cost less, are less likely to leave their jobs, and are healthier. Or, as a 2005 paper that did a meta-analysis of some 225 papers with over 275,000 participants put it, happiness leads to success in nearly every domain of our lives, including marriage, health, friendship, community involvement, creativity, and in particular, our jobs, careers, and businesses. The meta-analysts showed that people who felt happy were more likely to secure job interviews, be evaluated more positively by supervisors, show superior performance and productivity, and be better managers. Here's the really interesting part, though. It intuitively makes sense that happy people do better. It's because of their success they're happy, right? Wrong. From that same meta-analysis, study after study shows that happiness precedes important outcomes and indicators of thriving. That's right. People aren't happy because they're successful. They're successful because they're happy. Happiness is a predictive measure, and performance improves even if people are only a little bit happier. You don't have to change someone's life dramatically to make them happier, at least temporarily. Even just a little bit of happiness leads to markedly better outcomes. People don't have to be deliriously wedding day happy, just a little bit happier than they were. Of course, making them even happier has an even greater effect, but the message I want you to take away from this is simple. Even small gestures can have great impact. What Scrum is focused on is taking those small things and systematically building them up into a scaffolding for success. Just one thing at a time, and you can actually change the world. I'm going to give you a toolkit to measure your happiness and the happiness of your team, company, and family, as well as any organization you happen to be involved with. That is what Scrum does. Forget trust-building exercises, and instead, build trust every single day. And I want you to measure it. It's not enough to think people are happy. I want you to be a scientist about it. Quantify it and equate it with performance. If something doesn't match up, there's a problem. It's great to go to the pub with your team and bond, but it doesn't do the company a lot of good if that bonding doesn't actually translate into better performance. There are a lot of people I hang out with just for fun. With my team, I want that social aspect to move directly into performance. And it does. Quantifying happiness. How do we make ourselves, our employees, and our fellow team members happy? How do we channel that happiness into greater productivity and revenue? To answer those questions, I need to take you back to Toyota and Taichi Ono's crusade to eliminate waste. That goal led him to the idea of continuous improvement. It isn't enough to reach a certain level of productivity and stay there. The idea is to constantly examine your processes so as to improve them constantly and forever. Perfection can never be reached, of course, but every increment in that direction counts. Just as work needs to be broken down into manageable chunks, and time needs to be broken down into manageable pieces, improvement needs to be sliced to a step at a time. In Japanese, the word used is kaizen, or improvement. What is the little improvement that can be done right away that will make things better? In Scrum, this is captured at the end of each sprint in what I call the sprint retrospective. After the team has shown what they've accomplished during the last sprint, that thing that is done and can potentially be shipped to customers for feedback, they sit down and think about what went right, what could have gone better, and what can be made better in the next sprint. What is the improvement in the process that they, as a team, can implement right away? To be effective, this meeting requires a certain amount of emotional maturity and an atmosphere of trust. The key thing to remember is that you're not seeking someone to blame. You're looking at the process. Why did that happen that way? Why did we miss that? What could make us faster? It is crucial that people as a team take responsibility for their process and outcomes and seek solutions as a team. At the same time, people have to have the fortitude to bring up the issues that are really bothering them in a way that is solution-oriented rather than accusatory. And the rest of the team has to have the maturity to hear the feedback, take it in, and look for a solution rather than get defensive. The retrospective meeting is the check part of Deming's plan, do, check, act cycle. The key is getting to that act step, that kaizen, which will actually change the process and make it better the next time. It's not good enough merely to share how you feel. You need to be able to act. The best way I've found to capture all this is with what I call the happiness metric. It's a simple but very effective way of getting at what the kaizen should be, but also which kaizen will make people the happiest. And I've used it with pretty remarkable results. Here's how it works. At the end of each sprint, each person on the team answers just a few questions. 1. On a scale from 1 to 5, how do you feel about your role in the company? 2. On the same scale, how do you feel about the company as a whole? 3. Why do you feel that way? 4. What one thing would make you happier in the next sprint? That's it. It can be done in just a few minutes. Every person on the team takes a turn, and it sparks really insightful conversations. Together, the team usually comes up with a kaizen quite quickly. The method exposes what is most important to each team member and what they think is most important for the company. And here's the crucial piece. The team takes that one top improvement and makes it the most important thing to do in the next sprint with acceptance tests. How can you prove you've made that improvement? You need to define what success is in a concrete, actionable way so that in the next sprint retrospective, it's really easy to see if you achieved the Kaizen. A couple of years ago, I decided to expand my company, Scrum Inc., into a full-service Scrum consultancy. We tracked our velocity and found we were finishing about 40 points of stories every one-week sprint. When I implemented the happiness metric, the first thing that emerged was that our user stories weren't good enough. They weren't ready enough. They didn't have a definition of done, and they were too vague. I worked on it, and we started to get better stories. During the next sprint, the user stories still weren't good enough. Our happiness numbers reflected that. In the third sprint, another issue emerged. We addressed it, and so it went. In just a few weeks, our velocity accelerated from 40 points per sprint to 120. We tripled productivity simply by asking what would make people happier. As a result, our customers were happier, and our revenue dramatically shot up. All I had to do was start asking the team what would make you happier, and then deliver on it. We graphed this data over time and saw some extraordinarily interesting things. As a CEO, I'm focused on what's going to happen in the future to our revenue, growth, and productivity. Unlike with financial metrics, I found the happiness metric to be predictive. Financials look at what happened in the past, but when you ask people how happy they are, they actually project into the future. And when they think about how happy they are with the company, they start projecting out how they think the company is doing. As a result, you'll get indications before a problem arises that one is coming. And if you pay close enough attention to what your team is telling you, you can take action and fix the issue before it becomes a problem. A drop in happiness can precede a drop in velocity or productivity by weeks. If you were only looking at productivity, you wouldn't know that there was a problem until it dropped off a cliff. But if you notice a team-wide drop in happiness, even as productivity is increasing, you know you have an issue that you need to address, and soon. Make everything visible. What are the things that actually make people happy? They're the same things that make great teams. Autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Or to say it more expansively, it's the ability to control your own destiny, it's the feeling that you're getting better at something, and it's knowing that you're serving something bigger than yourself. But there are also some easy, concrete steps management can take to get the culture of the company to encourage those qualities. One element of Scrum that's often a prelude to achieving autonomy, mastery, and purpose is transparency. The idea is that there should be no secret cabal, no hidden agendas, nothing behind the curtain. Far too often in a company, it isn't really clear what everyone is working on or how each person's daily activity advances the goals of the company. When I was starting Scrum, I spent a lot of time thinking about the laws a good friend of mine was influential in introducing into the Colorado legislature, sunshine laws. They require that all public meetings be open, all records be available to the public, and that there be nothing taking place behind closed doors. Nothing hidden. That's why in Scrum, anyone can go to any meeting. Any stakeholder can observe a daily stand-up or attend a review. What I wanted to do was to make everything visible, and this can be scary to some people. Patient Keeper is a company that develops handheld applications for hospitals and doctors. When I was hired into the company, I immediately made all of engineering a Scrum shop. I told the developers that everyone would know everything. They were so used to seeing measurements getting used to beat them up that the new level of transparency made them afraid they'd only be abused more. Trust me, I said, this won't be used to hurt you or punish you. It will only be used to make things better. As I've said before, I'm not very interested in individual performance. I'm only interested in team performance. I can double a team's productivity in a month, but an individual, that could take a year. And a whole bunch of individuals, a whole division, a whole company, that could take forever. So I use transparency to focus on improving the team. I find that the team itself usually can address individual performance issues. They actually know what people are doing, who is helping, who is hurting, who makes the team great, and who makes it painful. So in Scrum, everything is visible. In my companies, every salary, every financial, every expenditure is available to everyone. I've never understood why anyone would want to keep this stuff secret except to further their own individual agenda or to keep people infantilized. I want the administrative assistant to be able to read the profit and loss statement and to understand precisely how what he does contributes to that. I want everyone in the company to be aligned with a unified purpose. Atomizing people into informational silos simply slows everyone down. Plus, it breeds suspicion and distrust. It divides a company into the big boys who know stuff and the peons who merely execute segments of some mysterious agenda they aren't capable of understanding. Bullshit. If you can't trust the people you're hiring to be on board with what you're doing, you're hiring the wrong people, and you've set up a system that has failure built in. The most dramatic visual representation of this idea, and one you'll see in every Scrum team room across the planet, is the Scrum board. Now, there is software out there that can measure all sorts of things, give you all sorts of metrics and analysis, but a Scrum board is just a bunch of sticky notes on a whiteboard. There are three task status levels: to do, doing, done. When someone signs out a story, everyone knows who's working on it, and everyone knows when it's done. And because the board has sticky notes that represent everything that needs to be done in a single sprint, everyone knows how the sprint is going. Anyone can walk into the room, glance at the board, and know exactly how the team is doing. Because the team knows what has been done and what still needs to be done, they can regulate themselves. They know what they have to do. They can see if a colleague is in trouble, if a story has been in the doing column too long. The team can self-organize to defeat problems that become obvious once everything is transparent. At PatientKeeper, the transparency that those developers were initially wary of paid off. Because all the work was transparent, we were able to coordinate assignments across multiple teams. Everyone knew exactly what everyone else was working on all the time. They could support one another if someone ran up against a roadblock. One developer might have already come up with a solution to a problem another developer faced, even if they weren't on the same team. Productivity at PatientKeeper increased more than 4 times. We released a production version of an enterprise software product 45 times a year. This isn't Angry Birds updating. This is stuff deployed at major hospitals that people's lives depend on. But because we were transparent with everything, we could get the product into the market faster than anyone in the world. That's what Sunshine can do. After I left PatientKeeper, a new management team decided Scrum wasn't the best way to run things anymore. The result? Product releases dropped from 45 a year to 2. Revenue dropped from $50 million a year to 25. And attrition, which had been at less than 10%, shot up to over 30%. They went from a great company back to mediocre performance by returning to traditional corporate behavior. Delivering happiness. One company that views happiness as core to its culture is Zappos. The wildly successful website convinced people to do something a lot of folks thought couldn't be done: buy shoes over the internet. CEO Tony Hsieh wrote a book about it, Delivering Happiness. Tony writes about the unique culture at Zappos, which is based on creating wow moments for customers. It turns out that to make customers happy, you want happy people on the other end of the phone. In talking to executives at Zappos, one of the words you hear a lot is connection. Their research shows that the more connected people are to other people at work, the happier they are and, apparently, the more productive and innovative as well. So the company execs have set out deliberately to create those connections, not only on one team or in one department, but across the whole company. And not just between people at one level, but between different levels. Everyone from VPs to accounts receivable clerks. They do this through means both simple and complex. For example, they physically encourage chance encounters. Their building has many exits, but they're all closed, save one, forcing people to go in and out through one door. The idea is that by having people bump into each other, they'll more likely create and nurture those connections. Another example relates to the way people are brought into the Zappos culture. Each employee, from a warehouse worker to a director, has to go through what Krista Foley, the senior manager of human resources at Zappos, calls boot camp. For 4 weeks, each employee is brought up to speed on how the company works, but also on how the company's culture works. It is really the second screening within the Zappos hiring process. Even after getting the job offer, you have to prove that you can absorb the culture. The results, says Foley, are remarkable. Those connections employees made during boot camp stay with them throughout their careers. Boot camp is purposefully intense. People have to show up at 7 a.m., work hard, meet deadlines, and pass tests. But it works. People who go through boot camp stay connected, not just for months, but for years, organizing their own reunions and barbecues to stay in touch. It becomes an extended family, says Zappos executive Rachel Brown. You take your work friends home with you. You hang out with them. Another way that Zappos keeps people happy is by giving employees a chance to learn and grow. The company almost always prefers to hire internally. Say a job in HR is posted and someone in accounting, who has always thought he might like that kind of work, sees it. That person who is curious about HR might then be brought into an apprenticeship. It gives the employee the chance to see if he really does like that work, and it gives the manager a chance to see if he'd make a good fit with the team. The company also offers free classes taught by other employees. Finance 101, coding for beginners, whatever. Zappos wants people to grow at and within the company. As I mentioned in Chapter 3 on teams, people want to grow. They want to get better at what they're doing and find what else they can get better at. The idea is that mastering work motivates people. Giving people the chance to find out where they fit helps Zappos keep employees happy, excited, and engaged. For many who've plugged along in a very traditional career, this culture can be a breath of fresh air. All of my career before Zappos, I was mostly focused on recruiting, says Foley. It was a rote job, she says, and she was burned out. Coming to Zappos reinvigorated her. It was the culture, she says. It's what makes me excited coming to work. That's what Zappos wants, what any company should want. It's what I want. I want people to love coming to work. It's a change in mindset, from working for a company to working with my company. It's a mindset that some people have a problem embracing. It's why Zappos focuses on internal promotions. They found that people who come in from the outside, especially at more senior levels, have a hard time adjusting. We're a mix of entrepreneurial and innovative, says Foley, but that's only half of it. The other half is collaboration. The company wants people to work together in relationships across the organization. This doesn't fit sometimes with standard corporate culture. One senior manager told me, I don't really have a title. We think as a group, we can do much better. Often at companies, you'll see managers who want to run their own area without transparency and without collaboration. They create an us versus them dynamic. Turf lines are drawn, and you can almost see the different divisions plotting against one another like something out of a Machiavellian medieval court. Imagine how much more productive a company would be if everyone worked together toward a common goal. Imagine a company that everyone thinks of as my company, where every day is a chance to get better, to do something better, to learn something new. Instead, most corporations set up an environment where people are more involved in politics than in making a profit. At Zappos, if you don't fit with the team and the culture, you don't fit in the company. Their annualized attrition rate is 12%, and most of the turnover, they say, is in their call center. That's because they fire people who aren't passionate about delivering for customers. Zappos sees those people as the public face of the company, and its standards are high. Folks at Zappos are flexible on a lot of things, but not on that. I've seen the same dynamic play out on teams. One person on a team might have specialized knowledge or skills, knowledge they hoard like misers. They see it as a possession that ensures their job. Scrum, through its retrospectives and transparency, illuminates this kind of behavior almost immediately. It becomes obvious where the roadblocks are, where the waste is. When I run a company, I tell those people with miser habits that they don't have the luxury of holding the team and the company hostage. They can either change their mindset or go work for someone else. Zappos has found that the more senior the new hire, the more ingrained their thinking, and therefore the harder they have to work to shed old ways of doing things. Scrum gives people a framework for doing that. It provides a structure for the whole organization to head toward a common goal. Its pillars are transparency, teamwork, and collaboration. Many companies now embrace that philosophy, and inevitably, those that don't lose out to those that do. Zappos went from $1.6 million in sales in 2000 to over $1 billion in 2008. That's a growth rate of 124% each year for 8 years in a row. I don't know about you, but I think that's a pretty convincing argument for making people happy. And Scrum is a toolkit you can use to get there. Pop the happy bubble. One thing happiness is not, at least the kind I'm talking about, is complacency. Rather, it's the opposite of that, positive and passionate engagement. As Krista Foley at Zappos says, happiness is the farthest thing from passivity. I love coming to work. Rather than encouraging you to become complacent, our positive and uplifting culture makes you work harder. They do have to screen out people who think that working at a happy place means not working. They want people who use joy as a driver. And they aren't alone in that. The Harvard Business Review focused its entire 2012 January-February issue on happiness. What they found was that the only route to employee happiness that also benefits shareholders is through a sense of fulfillment resulting from an important job done well. We should aspire not just to make employees happy, but to do so by helping them achieve great things. In short, we should earn our employees' passionate advocacy for the company's mission and success by helping them earn the passionate advocacy of customers. And that passionate advocacy has tangible benefits. Happy employees show up at work, they bear down harder, and not only do they not leave a company, they attract others like them who share the same drive. In their article for the HBR issue, Gretchen Spreitzer and Christine Porath decided not to call these people happy because of the connotations of complacency. Instead, they called them thriving. They found that these people performed 16% better than their peers, had 125% less burnout, were 32% more committed, and 46% more satisfied with their jobs. They took fewer sick days, had fewer doctor's appointments, and were more likely to get promoted. What these thrivers share is what I've been talking about throughout this chapter. Each thriver is vital and passionate, and each is trying to perfect their craft, whether they belong to an airplane crew or are a busboy in a restaurant. What can companies do to create an atmosphere in which people thrive? Managers can encourage autonomy by letting people make their own decisions about their job. And they can make sure that employees know everything that's going on, because, as they put it, doing your job in an information vacuum is tedious and uninspiring. Managers should also have zero tolerance for incivility and never allow an employee to poison corporate culture through abuse or disrespect. And finally, they should give quick and direct feedback. Scrum gives people all those things. It's set up to make them happen, especially the direct feedback, which happens every day in the daily stand-up meeting, and which is what the sprint retrospective and the happiness metric are designed to illuminate. There's one caution I'd like to lay out, though. It's possible. Heck, it happens often enough that I've spent significant time studying it for a happy bubble to develop. This usually happens after a team has achieved some big success or increased their productivity greatly by using Scrum. They've self-organized, and they feel proud of their progress. And that's when complacency can set in. They say to themselves, hey, we've improved so much, we don't need to improve anymore. They hit a productivity plateau, and pretty soon thereafter cease to do great work. But they're good enough that for a time, they live in this happy bubble that insulates them from unpleasant truths. They don't realize that continuous improvement means just that. It never, ever stops. When I was a fighter pilot, we used to say, after 3,000 hours in the cockpit, you need to quit because you become complacent, and that could kill you. While a complacent team might be less risky in business, ongoing team performance is at risk. This complacent attitude often reveals itself with a comment such as the following. We deserve to coast. We've earned it. Or individual team members value their team spirit and happiness so highly that they don't want to endanger it. Or they fear change itself, feeling that if what they have is working, why alter it? Because this is where the forms of Scrum can break down. Happy bubbles are one of my biggest concerns. I've seen it again and again. A team might be doing all the things Scrum teaches, prioritization, single tasking, cross-functionality, review rituals, but they've stopped improving. Often they're so much better than they were before learning Scrum, and they have the successes to prove it, but they rest on their laurels. They say, we don't need to get any better. It reminds me of the 2004 U.S. Olympic basketball team. There were some top players on that team, LeBron James, Tim Duncan, and Allen Iverson, to name just a few. And the United States had a history of not only winning, but dominating in the sport, particularly since professional players had been allowed to participate. The American basketball players knew they were the best, except that they weren't. They lost more games than any U.S. Olympic basketball team had ever lost. They lost to Lithuania. Their pride and complacency were their downfall. They were living in the happy bubble. So how do you pop the bubble before your players embarrass their country on live TV in front of billions of people? The first step is being aware of the problem, which is why I want teams to measure their velocity every sprint. I want to know what their rate of change is. If there isn't positive growth, I know we've got to bear down. And the person I depend on to do this is the scrum master. He or she needs to be able to see the problem and bring it up with the team. It's crucial that someone ask the hard questions. What you really want is a wise fool. I marvel what kin thou and thy daughters are, they'll have me whipped for speaking true. Thou'lt have me whipped for lying, and sometimes I am whipped for holding my peace. King Lear, Act 1, Scene 4. The wise fool is the person who asks uncomfortable questions or raises uncomfortable truths. These workers aren't always easy to have around, since they can be seen as troublemakers or not part of the team, but they need to be cultivated and used. Perhaps the best example is one we're all familiar with, from the classic Hans Christian Andersen story, The Emperor's New Clothes. As you'll recall, there was once an emperor who adored fine clothes so much, he had a different coat for every hour of the day. If you wanted to know where he was, the first place you looked was his changing room. One day, a few swindlers came to the emperor and swore they had a secret cloth that was so fine that those people who were unfit for office were unable to see it. They demanded the finest silk but only pretended to weave it, instead weaving only air, the fine materials going into their bags. The emperor came to check on their progress one day and saw nothing. Remembering that the cloth was only visible to those fit for office, he praised it as the finest he'd ever seen. He asked his advisors, but they too swore up and down that it was the most wondrous material ever. On the day of delivery, the swindlers carefully draped the emperor in nothing at all, to rave reviews from his court, and so the emperor decided to parade through his city, showing people the miraculous cloth. You remember how the story ends. No one said anything about the emperor's nakedness, not wanting to be seen as unfit themselves. So the royal procession continued down the avenue until a small child called out, "But he isn't wearing anything at all." At first, the child's father hushed him, but then, beginning with a whisper and growing to a shout, the people of the city started shouting, "He hasn't got anything on." The emperor, while fearing they were right, kept the procession going, and his courtiers followed him, holding a train that wasn't there. The wise fool is that child, the person who can see that the accepted truth is simply a consensual illusion and that really the emperor has no clothes. So if you have a wise fool or two, cherish them. There are other ways of popping the happy bubble. For example, by bringing in new blood and management intervention. But at the root, they're all the same. Bringing the team face to face with a reality they may not want to see. Fortunately, with Scrum, everything is transparent. How much the team is producing, the quality of their work, how happy the customer is. One of Scrum's virtues is that it makes the uncomfortable visible quickly. By contrast, traditional teams and organizations can blithely walk themselves off a cliff and wonder what possibly could have gone wrong. They wait too long to get actionable feedback from the market and from each other. Happy today, happy tomorrow. Psychologists, including Harvard's Ben Shahar, say that one way to analyze how people approach the world is by asking whether what they're doing makes them happy today and whether it will make them happier tomorrow. I found it a useful lens to look at people and work environments. People tend to fall into four types, according to Ben Shahar. The first type, the hedonist, is someone who is doing what makes them happy right now. Tomorrow, let tomorrow worry about tomorrow. I'll just enjoy today. I see this kind of behavior in a lot of startups, a bunch of people in the figurative garage just making stuff because it's cool and it's fun, but there isn't a lot of attention paid to creating a sustainable product. Very little mental energy is channeled into how this thing will be working in a month, let alone a year down the road. And what usually happens is that the investors in these guys get worried. So they hire a bunch of managers to ride herd on the hackers. And suddenly, the hackers find that the world they enjoyed so much now sucks. There are now all sorts of rules and tests and reports. It sucks today, and they think it will suck forever. Call them now the nihilists. Then there are the guys who were brought in to run the place. They're the ones willing to put in 80-hour weeks and willing to whip others to do so because they think they'll get promoted later and they'll be happier. Of course, when they do get promoted, they just have a new set of headaches to contend with that require more time. They enjoy the rat race. The fourth type of person is the one that Scrum tries to identify and encourage. The individual who is working at stuff that is fun today, but has an eye toward a better future and who is convinced it will be fun forever. This sort of person rarely experiences burnout or disillusionment. He's spared the negative feelings toward work suffered by the hedonists, the nihilists, and the rat race addicted managers who strive to make everyone toe the line. What Scrum does is promote a single galvanizing mindset. By having everyone work together, the team helps the hedonist look ahead, convinces the nihilist there is a future without whining, and tells those managers stuck in an unending rat race that there actually is a better way. That's why I implemented the happiness metric in my company. It helps the team help its members become better people. It removes the causes of unhappiness systematically, carefully, and incrementally. It empowers people to change themselves and attaches an incentive to doing so. Remember the fundamental attribution error? When you're surrounded by assholes, don't look for bad people, look for bad systems that reward them for acting that way. Then you use the happiness metric to fix it. In high school or college, many of us studied the American psychologist Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It laid out, in pyramid form, the needs that humans take care of first, and then those that become more pressing as lower ones are satisfied. At the pyramid's base are physiological needs: air, water, food, clothing, and shelter. If we don't have those, we can't even begin to think about anything else. The next layer is safety, not just physical and financial, but also the assurance of good health. It's important to have some access to medical care. Interestingly, many people stop there, even though the next layer holds what we absolutely need as humans, but that society often ignores: love and belonging. That connectedness Zappos talks about. Above that is the need for self-esteem and respect from others. And at the pyramid's very top is the need to achieve one's full potential. It's that top layer that Maslow was most interested in and that Scrum focuses on: helping people achieve personal growth and fulfillment. People high up on that pyramid are not only happier and more fulfilled, they're more effective and innovative, and they're able to deliver greatness. I can almost see you nodding now. Because we all know that pyramid on a gut level, even if some of us have never seen it spelled out. The trick is to move up to those lofty heights and then have a way of precisely gauging what impact you're having. If you're running a business, maybe you measure greatness by revenue and growth. If you're trying to make sick people better, maybe you measure greatness by the number of those who don't die. If you're trying to change the world, maybe you measure greatness by how much you changed it. If you're just trying to get your honey-do list done, maybe you measure greatness by how many weekend afternoons you have free to go fishing. It's not enough just to be happy. Happiness needs to be harnessed to produce results. All the elements of Scrum come together to help a person do just that. The real trick: priorities. We will talk about those next. The takeaway: it's the journey, not the destination. True happiness is found in the process, not the result. Often, we only reward results, but what we really want to reward is people striving toward greatness. Happy is the new black. It helps you make smarter decisions. Plus, when you're happy, you're more creative, less likely to leave your job, and more likely to accomplish far more than you ever anticipated. Quantify happiness. It's not enough just to feel good. You need to measure that feeling and compare it to actual performance. Other metrics look backward. Happiness is a future-looking metric. Get better every day and measure it. At the end of each sprint, the team should pick one small improvement, or Kaizen, that will make them happier, and that should become the most important thing they'll accomplish in the next sprint. Secrecy is poison. Nothing should be secret. Everyone should know everything, and that includes salaries and financials. Obfuscation only serves people who serve themselves. Make work visible. Have a board that shows all the work that needs to be done, what is being worked on, and what is actually done. Everyone should see it, and everyone should update it every day. Happiness is autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Everyone wants to control their own destiny, get better at what they do, and serve a purpose greater than themselves. Pop the happy bubble. Don't get so happy that you start believing your own bullshit. Make sure happiness is measured against performance, and if there is a disconnect, be prepared to act. Complacency is the enemy of success. Chapter 8. Priorities. I first met Scott Maxwell at Johnny's Luncheonette in Newton Center a few years ago. I've told you about him before. He's the founder of OpenView Venture Partners, and he's the one who figured out that working longer hours creates more work than it accomplishes. I've been working with OpenView and its portfolio companies for almost 8 years now, and in every single one, we've seen dramatic increases in productivity. But Scrum isn't just about making teams go faster. It's about boosting impact, which, in the case of the VC guys, takes a simple form, revenue. If a company isn't making money, you don't have a successful venture, you have a hobby. I can't tell you how many companies I've seen with great ideas and a really cool product, something that gets everyone excited, that seems to fill a market niche, that just seems as if it should be successful. It's just so cool. But despite megadoses of imagination, inspiration, and hard work, the people making the product can never figure out how to actually make money with it. What's the difference between a Pets.com and a Zappos? They both saw a market segment that people spend billions of dollars a year on. They both saw a way to deliver products more easily and cheaply online. One became emblematic of dot-com excess and the squandering of millions and millions of dollars. The other company is worth more than $1 billion. They both had vision. What Pets.com didn't have was a sense of priorities. They didn't know what to do when. Imagine a Venn diagram with three circles that overlap. What you can sell, what you can build, and what you can be passionate about. Where those three intersect is where you find your vision. Every company needs to think about that diagram. If you concentrate only on what you can build, you can end up making something that nobody actually wants, even if you're passionate about it. If you concentrate on what you can sell, you can promise things you can't build. If you only build what you can sell, but aren't passionate about, you end up working hard to build mediocrity. But in the center, that sweet spot, is a vision rooted in reality, a vision with a real possibility of becoming something great. In this chapter, I'm going to show you how to get there. The preceding chapters have focused on how to do things faster and better. This chapter is how to make faster and better work for you, how to achieve greatness. Scott Maxwell says that the true power of Scrum lies in its ready, prioritized, and sized backlog of what to do. This is why he implemented it at the Venture Group and why he thinks it is a critical competitive advantage. The backlog. What to do, when. The first thing you need to do when you're implementing Scrum is to create a backlog. It can be hundreds of items long or contain only the few things that you need to figure out first. Of course, you need a clear idea of what you want at the end of the work. It could be a product, a wedding, a service, a new vaccine, or a house painted. It could be anything. But once you have a vision, you need to consider what it will take to make that happen. There's a company I've been working with recently that builds automation systems for buildings. Heating, cooling, electric, plumbing, the whole kit and caboodle. One of their new products is a home automation system. They're building a system that can control every aspect of your home, from opening the front door, to controlling your heating costs, to turning on your lights, all from your mobile device. So they sat down and wrote out a list of everything they would need to make that happen. Switches, controllers, interfaces, sensors, communication protocols, whatever. Not the specific rules and pieces, actually, but all the stories they would need. So they wrote things such as a homeowner, I want to be able to see who is at my door so that I can open the door only for those people I want to come in. They wrote stories about opening the garage door, turning on the HVAC, controlling the lights. They kept writing until they had a list of all the things they thought their system would need to do to be a compelling purchase. The list turned out to be hundreds of items long. It's a big, complicated system. The idea behind the backlog is that it should have everything that could possibly be included in the product. You're never going to actually build it all, but you want a list of everything that could be included in that product vision. The key, though, is what you decide to do first. The questions you need to ask are, what are the items that have the biggest business impact, that are most important to the customer, that can make the most money, and are the easiest to do? You have to realize that there are a whole bunch of things on that list that you will never get to. But you want to get to the things that deliver the most value with the lowest risk first. With Scrum's incremental development and delivery, you want to begin with the things that will immediately create revenue, effectively de-risking the project. And you want to do that on the features level. You want to start delivering value to your customers as soon as you possibly can. You want something that is completely done, that you can show. It could be just a small part of the larger project, but it should be demonstrably done. If you're painting a house, maybe what's done first is all the trim in the living room. In product development, there's a hard and fast rule that has been proven over and over again. I talked about this earlier. 80% of the value is in 20% of the features. Think about that for a moment. In anything that you buy, most of the value, most of what people want, is in only a fifth of what has been built. In this company's case, they looked at this huge list of things that could be included in their home automation system, and they knew that customers really only wanted 20% of them. The trick of Scrum is figuring out how you build that 20% first. In traditional product development, teams don't know what that 20% is until they deliver the whole thing. That means that fully 80% of their effort is waste. And you know how I feel about waste. What if you could start delivering things 5 times faster than your competition with 5 times the value? That's a winning hand. So this automation company sat down with a huge list of features and asked themselves, okay, what do we do tomorrow? What's most important to the customer? How do we deliver value to them faster than anyone else? As Scott Maxwell says, the difficult part isn't figuring out what you want to accomplish, it's figuring out what you can accomplish. This is true whether you're building a house or car, writing a book or video game, or cleaning up crime or trash. Figure out where the most value can be delivered for the least effort and do that one right away. Then identify the next increment of value and the next. Faster than you think, you'll have created something or delivered something with demonstrable, real results. The key is prioritizing the work. How do you do that? Well, first, you need someone who can figure out both what the vision is and where the value lies. In Scrum, we call that person the product owner. The product owner. There are only 3 roles in Scrum. Either you're part of the team and you're doing the work, or you're a Scrum Master helping the team figure out how to do the work better, or you're a product owner. This is all laid out in the appendix, which you'll hear later. The product owner decides what the work should be. He or she owns the backlog, what's on it, and most important, what order it's in. When I started the first Scrum team in 1993, I didn't have a product owner. I was part of the leadership team and had a bunch of other responsibilities besides figuring out exactly what the team should do in each sprint. I carried out management and marketing duties, dealt with customers, and plotted strategy. But in that first sprint, I figured I could handle the backlog. I just needed to make sure I had enough stories and features for the team to work on during the next sprint. The problem was, after the second sprint, we introduced the daily stand-up meeting. Velocity went up 400% in the next sprint, and the team finished in a week what we thought would take us a month. There was no more backlog for them to work on. I thought I'd have a month to create more stories. A great problem to have, admittedly, but one that had to be addressed. So I thought about this role of product owner and what qualities someone would need to execute it properly. My inspiration for the role came from Toyota's chief engineer. A chief engineer at Toyota is responsible for a whole product line, such as the Corolla or the Camry. To do this, they have to draw on the talents of groups specializing in body engineering or chassis or electrical or whatever. The chief engineer has to draw from all those groups to create a cross-functional team capable of creating a car. Outside of Toyota, everyone thinks of these legendary chief engineers, or shushas, as they were originally called, as all-powerful leaders of the Toyota way. And in a way they are, but what they don't have is authority. No one reports to them. Rather, they report to their own groups. People can tell chief engineers that they're wrong, so they have to make sure they're right.